looking for signs of life on Wall Street.
Bring out your dead.
Here's one.
Ninepence.
I'm not dead.
What? Nothing. Here's your ninepence.
I'm not dead.
Here. He says he's not dead.
Yes, he is.
I'm not.
He isn't?
Well, he will be soon. He's very ill.
I'm getting better.
No, you're not. You'll be stone dead in a moment.
Investors are unloading Lehman Brothers stock. Is the investment bank dead or getting better? You're not fooling anyway. Anybody. Find out on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everybody. It's Wednesday, September 10th. Bring out your dead. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is away. Oil prices ignore OPEC's cut in production. That's a big story this morning. The people of North Korea wait for word on their future as there is doubt about the health of the president, their leader. Europeans switch on their doomsday machine. Just kidding. And Barack Obama is president of the world if the election were held today and everywhere except the United States. Those stories and more. But first, some headlines. Scientists say it's perfectly safe. The Large Hadron Collider is now running the biggest science experiment in the world, sending protons racing around a 17-mile tunnel far beneath Switzerland today. Project director Lynn Evans finally got to push the on button this morning.
Three, two, one, zero. Nothing. Yes, sir. Yes.
They're all looking to create the moment just after the Big Bang to answer questions about gravity and how the universe works. Investment bank giant Lehman Brothers is in a fight for survival this morning. Lehman's just announced third quarter losses of almost $4 billion and its plans to sell a majority stake in its investment management unit. OPEC ministers announced yesterday that they'll cut oil production by more than 500,000 barrels a day. It came as a surprise. Oil's made steep declines in recent weeks, but in Asian trading today, it's stabilized at just over $104 a barrel. Good morning, Femi. Okay, how am I doing here?
Good morning, John. We're also tracking a couple of other big stories. The Texas Gulf Coast is bracing for Hurricane Ike, and it may well hit sometime on Saturday morning. After drenching Cuba, the storm is gathering strength again. Forecasters say it could be a Category 3 by the time it strikes the United States. Authorities are already loading up buses and taking people inland. And where in the world is North Korea's leader Kim Jong-il? That's the question many are asking today. North Korea is denying rumours that he suffered a stroke. But Kim Jong-il wasn't part of yesterday's celebrations of the country's 60th anniversary. It's day three for talks on a power-sharing deal in Zimbabwe, and both parties say they're going well. The opposition is still insisting that the leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, become executive prime minister of the African nation.
After reacting positively to Lehman Brothers' announcement of its losses and third quarter developments, the stock market futures have turned south, expecting a lower opening. U.S. dollar is mostly higher against major currencies in trading. Gold is down. So the world's not going to end. Do you believe that, Femi?
I don't believe it's going to end. Scientists are just being polite.
If you did.
They're humoring us.
If you did,
yes.
What's on your to-do list? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at ResponsibilityProject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Shortly, we're going to go to France and Switzerland, where the activation of the super collider is taking place. That's the place where people believe that maybe stray black holes might end the world. We're wondering, how would your day be different if you knew the world was ending?
Hi, my name's Dan. I'm from Boston, Mass. And if I knew that the world was ending tomorrow, I definitely wouldn't have gone to work today. Have a nice day, guys.
BJ says on our site, is it just coincidence that some physicists predict that the Hadron will result in mini black holes that could bring about the end of the world in 4 years? Or is the year 2012 of more significance than we realize? What did the Mayans know? If you know what the Mayans know, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. It's a similar mystery in North Korea. Shadowy and reclusive leader Kim Jong-il noticeably absent from yesterday's 60th anniversary military parade in Pyongyang. Unconfirmed reports suggest Kim suffered a possible stroke. With no clear path of succession after Kim, is the fate of the hardline, famine-plagued communist state in doubt? Relations with South Korea and, of course, the issue of nuclear stability in the region and the West are all in the balance. Donald Gregg was the U.S. ambassador to South Korea from 1989 to 1993. He's chairman of the Korea Society here in New York. Ambassador Gregg, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Now, being the ambassador in South Korea means you have a very, close to the front of the stage seat for what goes on in North Korea, but it's still pretty difficult to determine what's happening in Pyongyang, correct?
Absolutely. I refer to North Korea as the longest-running failure in the history of American espionage, and I know what I'm talking about because I was with CIA for 30 years, and we didn't get very far in learning about what was going on in the North.
What do you think is going on right now? There is a report out of Pyongyang that suggests that there was a minor stroke, life not in danger. Kim Jong-il is still in control. What do you think?
I think that's about right. I think there's a lot of evidence that he has uncertain health, diabetes, and, stroke possibilities. But we're in touch with the North Koreans here in New York at the mission to the UN. They're calm. There's no scenes of panic in the North. I think there is a health issue. But I think the key point is, why are we still reduced to speculating like this, which is so redolent of the Cold War? And the reason is that instead of building on what Bill Clinton accomplished at the end of his term, George Bush refused to talk to North Korea directly for 6 years. And the result of that was North Korea firing a nuclear weapon and becoming a member of the nuclear club.
And, of course, the axis of evil, North Korea, is in that, according to the Bush administration. We should point out and remind listeners that Bill Clinton even suggested in the waning days of his second term that he would go to Pyongyang. It ultimately didn't happen, but that's the sort of temperature of relations at that time. What do you think the succession issue is here? There really isn't a lot of precedent since 1950.
No, Kim Jong-il was anointed by his father, Kim Il-sung, as the designated leader for more than a decade before his father's death. That has not been possible now. And so there's lots of speculation about whether one of his three sons will succeed. I doubt that that's going to happen. I think it's more likely that there will be some kind of collective leadership. But I think that I've been to North Korea 5 times. I think the way lies open for improved relations with North Korea if we're willing to deal seriously with them. George W. Bush has belatedly tried to do this with a very able secretary, Assistant Secretary Chris Hill, who's being sniped at constantly by John Bolton. And Senator McCain sounds as though he would continue a very hard line. I think that's not the way to go. I know from my trips to North Korea that their number one desire is improved relations with the United States. They fear us militarily.
Well, we should note that John Bolton is sort of out of the picture at this point, but your point is taken as far as the hard line is concerned. I'm wondering if South Korea is a driver here potentially. We've seen over the last year the emotional demonstrations against the United States regarding beef imports. I'm wondering if that drives South Korea to be more activist on dealing with the North here.
Well, I think that really started in 2000 when there was a summit meeting between Kim Dae-jung and Kim Jong-il, which went very well and really started a paradigm shift in Northeast Asia. That caused South Koreans to question whether our military presence was still as necessary as it has been. And so we have to keep a very good dialogue going with our ally in South Korea, who has been tremendously supportive of us in Desert Storm in 1991 and also in our adventure in Iraq. I think that the Lee Myung-bak administration is still getting its footing in terms of how it's going to relate to North Korea. But I think the way lies open for an intelligent resumption of dialogue with North Korea if we're smart enough to construct it.
Well, certainly, Ambassador, if there would be a change of leadership and a change of tone and approach in North Korea, it would obliterate some of the most longstanding Cold War ghosts that there are, the DMZ, the armistice, the Korean War, which technically hasn't even ended. All that could conceivably be swept away by a real sea change here. Donald Gregg, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Donald Gregg is the chairman of the board of the Korea Society here in New York. He's also the former U.S. ambassador to Korea. And as he mentioned, he was at the CIA for 30 years. So lots to talk about there concerning the rumors of ill health of Kim Jong-il, the leader of North Korea. Before we go to headlines, let's remind you of how you can reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. If the world was ending, as some suggest stray black holes from the super collider could produce, how would it change your day? What's on your to-do list? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And now, Femi Okeh is here.
Thank you, John. It is 28 minutes past the hour. Investment giant Lehman Brothers is hinting today that it's on the market. The nation's fourth largest investment bank is suffering $3.9 billion quarterly losses and is giving indications it might be put up for sale. The markets are responding. Futures are higher, signaling a strong open. Pakistani intelligence officials say that a missile has killed two top al-Qaeda operatives. Authorities say the strike happened Monday in Waziristan, the Taliban heavy tribal region in Pakistan's northwest. Pakistani officials say that they think the U.S. was behind the rocket attack. U.S.-led strikes inside Pakistan are now a new trend in recent weeks. Officials in the Texas area are preparing to bus residents with special needs from the Corpus Christi area to San Antonio ahead of Hurricane Ike. All evacuations are voluntary so far. Our forecasters say the storm could make landfall near Corpus Christi on Saturday. And when Sarah Palin referred to herself as a pit bull with lipstick, everybody laughed. But now Barack Obama is in trouble for using lipstick.
You can put lipstick on a pig. It's still a pig.
Oh, man.
The McCain campaign calls the comment offensive and disgraceful and says Obama owes Palin an apology.
The Obama
campaign says
New York Post.
He wasn't talking about Palin. He's talking about a pig.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, probing topical issues such as mothers who meet at a bar for drinks and bring their babies. Is it fair to the other patrons? Is it fair for bars to prohibit them? Conversations found at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. A couple of quick things. So we've been following the Lehman Brothers financial difficulties as the market opens this morning. There's a conference call describing their third quarter losses. On the New York Times live blog, Floyd Norris said that the CEO, Dick Fuld, started the call by saying Lehman was de-risking the balance sheet. Floyd Norris says it's a new word to me, de-risking. Ever heard that word before? A long-standing tradition of corporate America torturing the English language and more today. Also, if you want to vote and are having trouble picking your candidate before you get to the booth, we've got a new tool on Facebook. Who should I vote for? You enter three qualities you'd like to see in your next president, and Facebook users will tell you who you should vote for. Go to thetakeaway.org. We now go in our continuing coverage of the Large Hadron Super Collider. We go now live to Geneva.
Get set! Go! Throw the second switch! Throw the third switch!
Not the third switch.
Throw it, I say! Throw it!
Well, they threw the third switch, but it didn't sound like that. That's from the movie Young Frankenstein. But it's electric beneath the European Alps. The testing for the ambitious experiment into the nature of the universe began today. Researchers deep underground near Geneva fired some atomic particles at close to the speed of light around a 17-mile circular tunnel. Joining us now is BBC science correspondent Tom Fielden. He was at the Center for Nuclear Research, or CERN, right there for the launch. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
You're welcome.
You know, this is a really important moment in physics. A whole lot of propositions that have been argued about incessantly for a generation could conceivably be tested. What was it like when you were there this morning?
Oh, it really was fantastically exciting here. First beam, as they call it, the first attempt to get protons round the machine, was achieved about 3 hours ago, and there was raucous applause here in a packed control room. Things had been a little tense up to that point. There was a problem with a cooling system, and that had really threatened to derail the whole launch of the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, this machine. But after a few false starts, they finally got the beam up and running. And as we speak, protons are circulating round the machine at the moment, and they're even talking about getting a second stream going in the other direction, which really is way ahead of schedule.
Explain a little bit to us the science of actually the machine itself. I mean, the magnetics that are required to keep the beam of protons in a straight line, the monitoring of the beam, and the computers required for taking care of all of the complicated and very, very precise electronics here. That's a scientific achievement in itself.
It really is. They're describing it as one of the great achievements of engineering, and a lot of original physics has had to go into those achievements along the way. They've got a 27-kilometer-long tunnel here with two tubes in it, one firing protons in one direction and one firing them in the other, and they're at four strategic locations along this tube. Those streams of protons, billions of protons, get crossed, smash into each other head-on, and that's where you get the exciting new physics that this is all about. But just building the machine, 6,000, I think, of these dipole magnets, all in a huge circle going around for 27 kilometers, has been a phenomenal achievement of engineering.
Now, the size of the machine isn't simply to impress the protons. You actually need that size to create the energy levels that approach the early moments after the Big Bang, correct?
That's right. This is all about getting those protons flying around this ring at really within, I think, about 20 kilometers an hour of the speed of light. That's how fast they have to get them, so that when they smash into each other head-on, the amount of energy released is enough to create particles that haven't been seen in the universe since the Big Bang. We're talking about getting back, winding the clock back, winding the film back, if you like, to a point 1/1,000,000,000th of a second after the Big Bang.
And that was before the BBC existed, actually, if such a thing can be imagined. Right. Now, one of the, you know, for all the people who are out there saying, so who cares about this and why does it matter to me? There's actually one professor, Peter Higgs, whose name was given to an elusive particle which, if the super collider finds it, will transform our view of gravity. He has visited the site of this super collider with you. How emotional do you think this moment is for him?
It was certainly very emotional when he was here in April. He's quite an old man now. I think he's in his 80s, Peter Higgs. He's an Edinburgh physicist who came up with a solution, if you like, a theoretical mathematical solution to a gap in our knowledge about the most basic and fundamental level of the material world. And he came up with this idea, and people thought, well, that's just unprovable, we can't test that, you know. And for 20 years people didn't really take it very seriously, but slowly over time people have begun to take that idea much more seriously, and this machine is in huge part been built to try and answer that question. Does the Higgs boson, as it was named after him, exist? And if it does it solve this missing link, if you like, in what they call the standard model of particle physics, which really tells us all about the interrelationships going on in the subatomic world and what matter is really made of?
Right. Now, Tom, I know you're a keen observer in the scientific world, and I noticed that the CERN facility is below ground there. Above ground, there on the border between Switzerland and France, it's farmland, right?
It is wonderful, beautiful countryside here. We've got the Alps on one side, got the Jura Mountains on the other. We're in a lovely valley here.
Now, when the particles actually reach the moment that they're smashed and the particles are created around the early moments after the Big Bang, do you suspect the cows are going to like behave any differently up on the surface? Will they chew differently?
We did have one report. A man's wife phoned him here and said the dog is now barking at the ground in a very unusual way. And he did say, well, the tunnel goes right under my house, so maybe there's something in that. But no, I mean, what's going on here is happening hundreds of feet underground, and it is contained in this tunnel and then the four experimental sites, these huge detectors that have been built to monitor what flies off from this moment of impact. But we shouldn't know too much about it on the surface.
Black holes in the milk. Tom Field and BBC's science correspondent, thanks for joining us. Tom Field, and of course, was there for the turning on of the Super Collider near Geneva. And with the rest of the news, Femi, okay.
Thank you very much. Just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. The owner and managers of Agriprocessors, that's the nation's largest kosher meatpacking plant, have been charged with more than 9,000 misdemeanors. They're accused of hiring minors and, in some cases, having children younger than 16 handle dangerous equipment, including circular saws, meat grinders, and power shears. Nervous Texas residents are gearing up for Hurricane Ike, which may well hit the Texas coast this weekend. Ike devastated parts of Cuba and Haiti, killing more than 1,000 people and forcing millions from their homes. Investment giant Lehman Brothers is trying to stay afloat. The bank announced it will sell the majority stake in its investment management unit. Lehman also disclosed losses of $3.9 billion in the third quarter. King Jong Il is not ill, excuse the pun. That's according to North Korean officials. Reports from the US and South Korean intelligence say that the North Korean leader may have suffered a stroke last month. That's a look at some of your main news headlines for this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Adore You Doji is away. In North Korea, we were just talking about it, and all around the world, people are left to wonder. The leader of North Korea is out of sight, rumors of ill health or worse, the world's most secretive and isolated nation in transition, apparently, behind the scenes. Yet in late February of this year, the New York Philharmonic got a glimpse of what it's like in this nation that rarely shows its face to the world. On a historic concert tour, the orchestra performed in Pyongyang. This is them playing the North Korean national anthem, a symbol for diplomatic gestures to come, perhaps. But there was one particularly emotional moment when the orchestra played Arirang in the North Korean capital. That song is probably one of the most popular and best-known folk songs in both North and South Korea. First, you'll hear the song and then the voice of WNYC's John Schaefer, who was there with the orchestra and was drawn deep into this emotional, seductive encounter with the most unusual place and people.
But the audience wasn't done. They kept applauding. And finally, Glenn Dichterow, the concertmaster, had to get the troops up and out of there. So he stood up, and they stood up, and they started filing off. As they did that, members of the audience started waving goodbye, and the musicians start waving back. And you could see that some of them were getting kind of misty-eyed. And sure enough, I ran backstage afterwards, and a couple of the musicians were just literally drying their eyes and were really moved by the kind of show of gratitude.
WNYC's John Schaefer, culture and music, a bridge over the axis of evil? A sign of hope, perhaps?
This journey is a manifestation of the power of music to unite people. It is our sincere hope that these concerts will aid in the beginning of a new era between the peoples of our nations.
That's New York Philharmonic President Zarin Mehta. And here's a much more skeptical White House spokesman, Dana Perino.
We consider this concert to be a concert, and it's not a diplomatic, coup. And there's a lot of things that it is not. What it is a wonderful concert that the New York Philharmonic put on for the North Koreans, for those who were able to see it.
We don't know what Kim Jong-il thought of the concert. He wasn't there. The orchestra's visit coincided with some particularly tense nuclear negotiations. But the symbolism and the potential for an opening was there, nonetheless, in the music of Western composers. Dvorak's New World Symphony, among the Western pieces the orchestra played during its visit. As rumors swirl about the health of Kim Jong-il and the potential for a change of leadership, it's a whole new world to contemplate for East and West. On thetakeaway.org, you can hear more of the Philharmonic's historic visit to North Korea.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. We begin with headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thanks, John. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. 9,000 physicists from around the world are waiting their turn. The $3.8 billion Large Hadron Collider was turned on today and began firing protons. The machine is located hundreds of feet below the ground on the French-Swiss border. Scientists say it's their best hope of understanding the makeup of the universe. In the largest settlement in the history of U.S. securities fraud cases, Enron shareholders and investors will split more than $7.2 billion from financial institutions accused of playing a role in the energy giant's downfall. About 1.5 million people and entities are eligible to share in the distribution of the money. A powerful earthquake has struck southern Iran. The U.S. Geological Survey said the quake had a magnitude of 6.1. Reports say that some buildings have been destroyed, but details of casualties are not yet clear. The second highest-ranking politician in North Korea has denied rumors that the country's leader Kim Jong-il is seriously unwell. Kim missed celebrations in Pyongyang yesterday that marked the 60th anniversary of the country's founding. That led to widespread speculation that he is sick, a lot of speculation coming from Associated Press and their various sources saying that the one source said that they believed that Kim actually underwent some surgery, but perhaps we'll get more details on that story in the forthcoming days.
Surgery for an unspecified circulatory ailment.
It's almost like a sources of a source said this,
And it's North Korea.
Exactly. A federal appeals court has overturned the 2007 conviction of a former sheriff's deputy for the abduction and killing of two black teenagers in Mississippi in 1964. An appeals court said that James Roy Sill could not be tried for the crime because of a five-year statute of limitations on kidnapping-related offences had expired. John.
Thank you, Femi. So in the headlines constantly these days are rapid developments that are taking place in brain science, both in the nature and diagnosis of mental illness, actually even taking pictures of the brain itself. Diagnostic tools exist these days that we would have, to do things that we would have never thought possible, even as recently as a decade ago. That means more and more people are coming in for evaluations for mental illnesses who may have never before, particularly young children. Bipolar disorder is very hard to treat in an adult, but what happens when the diagnosis is for a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old? And what does an early diagnosis mean? Is it a lifetime of battling the disease? What are the consequences for parents and children who grow up with a diagnosis of bipolar disorder? In an amazing article in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine, writer Jennifer Egan visits with families going through this experience and who have found that a little information sometimes can be a very dangerous thing. Jennifer Egan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You spent a lot of time with families who have had this diagnosis, and I'm wondering if you could tell anything about the experience of the parents who, first of all, decided to actually even get their children tested, and then how they live with the diagnosis and the medication and the complicated therapies that are the consequence of such a diagnosis.
Well, the first thing I would say is that there's among the families I spent time with, and there were many, the kids are really not all alike, which does speak to the question of whether these kids ultimately will end up being called bipolar. But one thing that they really do all have in common is that they have severe problems. Most of them are unable to function in a normal school, and a significant portion of them express their mental illness in the form of a very explosive and oppositional kind of anger. So it's a huge challenge for the families, and I think that in a way, the most poignant thing was to see that in families that have more than one child, the way that this worked among siblings, especially if the impaired child was the older one, there really was a lot of what I would call abuse toward the younger sibling, which was impossible for the parents to completely control and incredibly painful and really agonizing to see.
Certainly, parents who grow up with children with maybe more traditional illnesses or even sort of episodic health problems are taught to kind of take a detached approach, let the medicine work, make sure the child is compliant with the therapy, and then they'll get better on their own. But in a mental illness case, the parents have to be much more intervening in the daily sort of affairs of the child. I'm wondering if parents have the expertise to deal with the kinds of circumstances that you talk about in your article.
It's interesting that you say that. I mean, a lot of parents say that they feel like they are essentially the healthcare professionals because not only do they have to dispense the medication and deal with the children on a day-to-day basis, but their description of the child's activities and moods is largely what determines the diagnosis, believe it or not. Because you can't just, you know, insurance tends to pay for about an hour or an hour and a half of evaluation. Anyone with a child knows if you bring the child to a doctor, generally the child becomes asymptomatic at the moment of walking in the door.
And yeah, I've noticed that.
That can be true of mentally ill children, too. So you can't expect them to manifest the behavior in that amount of time. So parental report is a huge part of the diagnosis. And yes, it's a huge challenge. I mean, especially when the behavior in question is behavior that involves a risk or a threat to the child, him or herself, or other kids. Mm. I mean, I talked to many parents whose kids had seriously hurt other children, you know, thrown a pool ball at someone, bitten through someone's clothing. So it's a huge responsibility. And what I found, it was surprising to me how calm and really impressive a lot of the parents were having come through some of this. But in other cases, I was working with some families who ended up feeling that they were ill-equipped to handle the behavior ultimately and decided to send their children away for residential schooling. And that's obviously a huge decision and
course.
A wrenching one.
Yeah. You know, normally in a story like this, we would begin with some alarming statistics on the rise of this or that diagnosis or this or that therapy. And I deliberately didn't do that on this time because in your article, you really describe how difficult it is even to sort out the statistics in this story. Describe what it is that you found.
Well, one thing my editor kept saying was, how many children are bipolar, have this diagnosis in America? We need that number. In fact, there really is no such number right now. I mean, there was an alarming study that came out last fall announcing that there had been a 40-fold increase in the number of pediatric bipolar diagnoses. And I think, in a way, a lot of the alarming articles ran then. But it's hard to know what to make of that statistic. It measures the number of time children go to the doctor. It doesn't measure the number of children with a diagnosis, and at the time that the study began, there were essentially zero children being diagnosed with this. So it's really hard to say. I mean, anecdotally, what I would say is that most of the professionals, most of the leaders in the field that I talk to, even those who are strong advocates for diagnosing this freely, who believe it's common, still felt it was being overdiagnosed and misdiagnosed. It seems like it has a little bit become the diagnosis of default if a child, say, is hospitalized and has mood problems. They will often walk out with a bipolar diagnosis. But what most clinicians say is, look, we don't understand the diagnosis yet, and everyone kind of agrees on that. We need to watch these kids grow up and see what's actually wrong with them, but we can treat the symptoms. So I think that's what the clinicians end up having to do, and it's imperfect. I mean, everyone would like to know exactly what's going on, but that right now that is not entirely possible.
Well, in fact, what you're describing is a kind of a giant longitudinal experiment in families who have this disorder, or trying to figure out what are the consequences as the kids grow up, and that's not going to be known until they do grow up, and perhaps that data will benefit families, you know, in the next generation. Your article, and you spent 7 months researching it, which is impressive in and of itself, comes at a time when there are really exciting developments in brain research. What is the sense, quickly before we go, of the development of biological markers or tests for parents to know early on what it is they're facing?
There is a sense that that will solve a lot of our problems. I mean, and in fact, take a lot of the stigma off of mental illness, because a lot of that is about the fact that we can't see it, we can't measure it, we can interpret it, but we can't name it in the way we can cancer and other things. So the hope is that by developing these markers, we'll be able to say to someone, you are at risk for this. Take precautionary steps so that hopefully they won't get it at all. And if they do, know exactly what the appropriate or better, what the appropriate protocol will be. I think there's a lot of hope placed on finding those markers.
Jennifer Egan, thank you very much for joining us.
That was a pleasure. Thanks.
Jennifer Egan is a novelist and writer. Her article about the challenges for parents of bipolar children appears in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Lots of ways to catch up with us on The Takeaway. We're talking about super colliders. Put on your apocalyptic hat and tell us, if the world's going to end, what's the last thing you would do?
Good morning. This is Troy calling from North Dakota. And if the world were ending tomorrow and I had a little bit of free time, I would go around and acquire as many of those silly plastic guitars from those Guitar Hero and Rock Band video games that I could, and I would destroy them, smash them on the stage perhaps, or throw them into a black hole, simply because they would be the reason why so many young people wasted their final days.
Well, Troy, I'm glad you were able to get that out. If the end of the world is coming, here's the takeaway.
A man's wife phoned him here and said the dog is now barking at the ground in a very unusual way, and he did say, well, the tunnel goes right under my house.
BBC science correspondent Tom Fieldon at the Center for Nuclear Research. See you on Friend Feed and Twitter. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Life and death in L.A. A murder mystery unfolds when a reporter finds some bodies. Victims under the radar conceal a crime, getting away with serial murder. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's an All-80s Wednesday here on The Takeaway. It's September 10th. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is away. An Alaska senator faces the music in Washington. OPEC may have killed the golden goose as oil prices continue to fall, sort of. Fancy wheel work at the Paralympics and the footprints of Hurricane Ike are not pretty. First, some headlines. The Large Hadron Collider was switched on this morning in Switzerland after years of planning and preparation. They spent $8 billion on it. Project director Lynn Evans says it all went off without a hitch.
It's been absolutely incredible.
You felt it yourself. The atmosphere was electric in the control room this morning.
17-mile ring that's buried far underground will smash protons together at near the speed of light to determine the origins of the universe. Lehman Brothers released some dismal numbers this morning. Almost $4 billion in losses for the third quarter. CEO Dick Fuld also announced a large-scale reorganization to reduce future risk for shareholders.
These will accomplish a substantial de-risking of our balance sheet and reinforce the emphasis on our client-focused businesses.
If you can find de-risking in the dictionary, please give us a call. The market is reacting this morning. The Dow is set to open higher after tanking yesterday. Lehman Brothers dragged the market down with devastating losses of 45%. Oil prices are heading back up, but they're bouncing around a little bit as well. They've dropped precipitously from a high of almost $150 a barrel in July. Femi, what am I missing here? Femi, okay?
Hello there, John. We are still tracking Hurricane Ike. The Texas Gulf Coast is bracing for Ike to hit sometime on Saturday morning. After drenching Cuba, the storm is gathering strength again. Forecasters say it could be a Category 3 by the time it strikes the US. Defense Secretary Robert Gates will testify on Capitol Hill today. He's expected to talk up recent security gains in Iraq, but warns that further troop reductions must be done with balance and care. President Bush announced yesterday that more troops are coming out of Iraq, while others head to Afghanistan. And following in the footsteps of sports giants like Michael Jordan and Brett Favre, cyclist Lance Armstrong says he's coming out of retirement. The seven-time winner of the Tour de France says he wants to go for an eighth win. And in politics, Barack Obama is in Virginia this morning, and John McCain is in Virginia and Philadelphia later today. John.
Obama's going to be on Letterman tonight, right?
Yeah.
He's probably going to be asked about his pig comment, don't you think?
I think he might just be.
The Dow fell 2.5% yesterday. The market is poised to open positively. All about Lehman Brothers and the oil production cut by OPEC. Big surprise yesterday. So the world is probably not going to end with the super collider on. But if you put on your apocalyptic hat, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE and tell us, what would you do? What's on your to-do list if you knew the world was ending today or in a week or a month? What would you get done? Would you clean a garage, something like that? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with a report on a total eclipse, not of the sun, but of the political elite in Alaska. It's been complete for a few weeks now, or for at least a week. Sarah Palin's ascendancy, she's the governor of Alaska, of course, the vice presidential running mate for John McCain, but her ascendancy has wiped out the headlines of anything else going on in Alaska, but that's going to change today. Ted Stevens, the longest-serving senator from Alaska, Republican, peeks out from behind the Palin shadow, and it turns out he's in the Senate race of his life. His trial on corruption charges moves forward today. What happens in the case could have an impact on control of the Senate and on the presidential race. Libby Casey is in Washington covering this case, the Ted Stevens case, for the Alaska Public Radio Network. Libby, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. You're welcome.
I mean, when the original allegations broke, it was a big enough story. But now in the wake of the Palin ascendancy, where Sarah Palin has actually claimed she's running against the political establishment that includes Ted Stevens, this hearing today is perhaps even more important. What do you expect to happen today?
It is. Well, Alaskans always knew we were the center of the universe, and now everyone else is realizing it,
there
too.
There we go.
Well, Senator Stevens has a hearing today. The judge is going to look at motions that both sides of the case have filed, and he's going to have to weed through a lot of motions. The prosecution has put forth some trying to introduce some new examples of Ted Stevens perhaps taking things without claiming them on his Senate financial disclosure forms. And the defense team has moved to dismiss the case for a variety of reasons. So the judge is going to have to weed through all of that in preparation for the court case, which starts in 2 weeks.
Do you detect a deliberate strategy on the part of the defense to delay this case past the election? And is there a sign that the judge doesn't want that to happen?
Well, it's sort of ironic because the way this all started out, the defense team asked to fast-track the case. Senator Stevens said that he wanted to prove his innocence before the November 4th general election. And the judge agreed. The prosecution moved quickly to give all their evidence over to the defense team. And now people are wondering, with all these motions to go through, how fast things will actually be able to move. Senator Stevens soared through his primary battle in Alaska a couple of weeks ago. He got 63% of the Republican vote. So he is going into the general election with that behind him, and we're all waiting to see now, as the trial actually gets started, if people are going to push to get it all done, because both sides have said it could be wrapped up in 4 weeks, which means it would finish up before the election, or will the defense team start to slow things down a little bit?
Well, Ted Stevens finds himself in a tight race with the Democratic challenger all of a sudden. Nevertheless, he appears to be confident that he can make some political hay out of this. What's the chance that this hearing actually, at least in terms of people in Alaska paying attention to it, becomes something of a campaign event for him and actually bolsters his chances?
Well, we'll just have to see how it unfolds today. It really depends on how vocal the defense team is at trying to get this case dismissed and how much they don't really talk to the media. So it really depends on how strongly that message gets back to Alaska that they believe this case has no merit. But regardless, Stevens is facing this really tough battle. And he has said, no matter what, he's not stepping down, he's not giving up, and he plans to go forward and take on the Democratic challenger in November.
Libby, take a listen to this. I guess we would call this the Palin factor.
Think of this. When you go to vote, don't go to vote alone. And you'll help Sarah become the next governor of Alaska, which we all want to see.
There's Ted Stevens campaigning for Sarah Palin. Is it possible that coattails of a high turnout for the Republican ticket could benefit Ted Stevens?
Absolutely. There may be a Palin bump. Alaskans were pretty apathetic about this election cycle. Republicans in Alaska, believe it or not, are not big fans of John McCain. For one, he's against drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and Alaskan Republicans are very much for that. And two, he's bumped heads with Senator Stevens a lot over the years, because Stevens is a big proponent of earmarks, bringing home the bacon to Alaska, and McCain has campaigned against that. And so when I interviewed delegates going to the Republican convention a couple of weeks ago, before Palin was picked, they were very sort of lukewarm about McCain and the future of the party. But now that Palin's on the ticket, we're expecting to see a lot more Republicans go out and vote for her. Hmm. Vote for her and vote for McCain. And of course, they'll probably just vote a straight ticket, which will likely give Senator Stevens a bump. And our Congressman Don Young, a Republican congressman who's also facing a tough battle. So this may end up helping the Republicans attempt to secure some seats in the House and Senate.
Oh, very interesting. Libby Casey, Washington correspondent for the Alaska Public Radio Network, covering the Ted Stevens trial, a hearing of which on corruption charges begins in Washington this morning. Now, when OPEC yesterday announced in a relatively surprise move that it would cut production by more than 500,000 barrels a day, it sent oil prices dropping. But this morning, they seem to be hovering around $103 a barrel today, up or down, depending on which moment you're looking at the market. Javier Blas is the commodities correspondent with the Financial Times. He joins us from London. Javier, we spoke a couple of hours ago. It seems as though there's a lot of volatility, even just in the early going here. What's going on?
The market is influenced not only by what is happening on OPEC, but it's also keeping an eye on what's happening on the U.S. Gulf of Mexico with the hurricane. And, of course, Lehman Brothers and what the Dow Jones is going to do is going to have some sort of influence in the price of oil. Here in Europe, we are seeing a bigger jump in oil prices. We are back above $100. We fell below $100 yesterday. So it looks like OPEC at least is getting some traction and keeping oil prices for falling more.
Can you tell us, you know, what happened in Vienna that motivated this cut? Because when I spoke with your colleague yesterday morning early, the consensus really seemed to be that production was going to be stable. But all of a sudden, something changed. What happened?
I think that one thing that delegates tell me, the delegates that are inside the room where ministers are talking, they tell me that ministers are keeping a very close eye on what is happening on the market while they are talking. And yesterday, where the ministers were starting the meeting very late at about 9 o'clock in the evening in Vienna, what they were watching is the NYMEX, the West Texas Intermediate U.S. crude oil, closing nearly $4 down. And probably that triggered some concerns among the most hawkish delegations, including the Iranians, the Venezuelans, but also very likely Nigeria and Libya, for a push on PR, public relations, to the market, telling the market we are not only cutting our production, that we were planning to do some kind of withdrawal of the extra barrels that we produce over the summer, but we are also going to tell you that we are doing this, and we are going to launch a very hawkish message that we want to protect oil prices. So that could just happen, that it was a reaction of yesterday's fall. But I think that also shows that some delegations within OPEC see now $100 as a floor for the price.
And in fact, a lot of these countries have made assumptions about oil being priced well above $100 a barrel, and all of a sudden they're facing a new reality. It's interesting, Javier, how interrelated all of this is. In a world of $140 a barrel oil, a country like Lehman Brothers probably would have an easier time finding a buyer for some of its bad assets than now at $100 a barrel, where there's less cash on the sidelines.
Well, yes, indeed. But I have to say that one of the reasons the global economy is getting some traction too, and is not slowing more, is because Middle East countries are spending massively. I mean, if you go to Dubai, Riyadh, Kuwait, there is a construction boom there. They are building a skyscraper after another one, and that's helping to keep the global economy growing. So in a way, we pay a price for $140 or $100 today oil prices when we drive our cars. But on the other hand, we are exporting a lot of more goods and services to those countries, thanks that they have booming economies.
So how did Russia figure into this latest blip in Vienna? Normally, Russia is kind of an independent here, but it seems they're moving more closely in alignment to the goals of OPEC.
I think it's too early to say. Russia has been a long-standing observer during the OPEC meetings, and they always send a delegation to the OPEC meetings. This time, the delegation is far larger and more senior. But we have talks in the past about Russia getting closer to OPEC, and we get nowhere with those talks. In particular, the Saudis don't see the relationship with Russia as a very good one for them. So I think it's too early to say that. I mean, it is evident that Russia wants a higher cooperation with OPEC. It's not so clear that OPEC wants a lot of more cooperation with Russia.
Well, Javier, thanks so much for joining us. A lot of volatility today. It'll be a very interesting trading day here in the United States, both on Wall Street and in the commodities pit. Javier Blas is commodities correspondent with the Financial Times. He joined us from London, talking about a couple of things: the 500,000 barrel a day production cut by OPEC, which appears to have stabilized the oil price at about $100 a barrel, and also the financial woes of Lehman Brothers. It's causing the opening on Wall Street to be, shall we say, mysterious.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. We've been talking politics this morning, politics in Alaska and national politics. It does seem like the campaign has been going on for months. But if you want to get a daily fix of the election through November, hey, we're here for you. Download our politics video podcast at thetakeaway.org. There's a link on our homepage, thetakeaway.org. And comment on anything on the program today at 877-8-MY-TAKE. But I want you to consider this storyline, this scenario for a minute, all right? What if for 23 years or so, white cheerleaders were being knocked off in Beverly Hills by a serial killer, and the police, for one reason or another, never told anyone? Now, that's a plot for a Hollywood movie, wouldn't you think? And if that was being pitched around Hollywood, it'd probably be getting a lot of attention. Well, take the cheerleaders out, the white Beverly Hills young ladies out of the story, and substitute young African-American women in L.A., and you've got the real-life story that Los Angeles journalist Christine Pelisek of the L.A. Weekly broke last week, that a serial killer has claimed 11 victims in South Central Los Angeles since 1985, despite a police task force set up last year quietly to investigate the killings. No public knowledge, nor mention to the victims' families and neighbors about a serial killer who has been murdering for 23 years. Joining us to talk about this L.A. shocker is Christine Pelisek. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, good morning.
This is a real amazing story that suggests the strategy of the police, their relationship with the African-American community, and a mysterious character who's been out there for 23 years. Tell us how you broke the story.
I heard about the story, I heard about it in 2006. I was dealing with the coroner's office, and they gave me a list of body dump cases where women had disappeared from 2002 to 2006. And I started looking at this list of 38 women. And after I looked at the list, I found out that some of the women had died from natural causes. Other ones had been killed by Johns or boyfriends. And there were a couple of remaining cases. One of them was a 14-year-old girl. And I ended up talking to the Inglewood detectives and found out from there that that case was related to eight cases from the LAPD. And so from there, I talked to the LAPD and I found out about some of the cases that way.
Is this a case where the social status and race of the victims actually conceals the crime in a sense?
I think a lot of the family members believe that way. When I was talking to them, you know, recently, a lot of them had said that had it been, you know, their daughter had lived in Beverly Hills, everything would have been different, they believe, anyway.
What's been the reaction in the community to this revelation?
Well, they've been really, the community's been extremely upset. I've talked to numerous members of the community, especially one of the families that I talked to. They live just off of Western Avenue because a lot of the killings happen along a stretch of Western Avenue in South Los Angeles. And a lot of the family members, their daughters lived around that area. And so when I told them, they were shocked and they didn't understand why the police hadn't put out any flyers or anything to alert the community. And some of the families, you know, said that they still had younger children that lived in the area. And so they were fearful and they didn't understand why the police hadn't alerted them.
You know, often in a case like this, and I'm thinking of, you know, famous stories about L.A. crime, there is a cop who actually takes on a case like this and personally makes it his own or her own cause. Anything like that going on in this case? And do the police have any leads?
Well, one of the detectives, actually, from the cold case unit, he was the one who put the cases together in 2005. And he was looking back at some of the cases because in 1988, from 1985 to 88, there were eight cases, and all the victims had died. They were shot. And so he ended up in 2005 looking back at those cases and putting the DNA, you know, what they found on the bodies, into the system. And he found all of a sudden he got two cases. A 1980 case popped up, and then a case in 2002 and 2003. So then he realized that, you know, there was a killer that had been killing for that long span. And so he's kept on the case, and they started a task force, so he's kept on with it. So he's been, you know, quite, you know, vigilant about, you know, trying to track this guy down. But it's very hard. The only clue that they have, there was a one surviving victim in 1988, and she described him as an African-American male in his 30s driving a red or orange Pinto. And that's really the only you know, description they have of him.
And clearly the Pinto is gone, and the man is no longer in his 30s, but he's still out there.
That's right. He took a 13-year break from 1988 and started again in 2002.
So what do you do in a case like this? I mean, can a community vigilance actually break this kind of a case, or does it take sophisticated DNA evidence to try to link these murders to an individual person?
The LAPD is trying to do that. They actually, there's something that's called familial DNA. They've found that the killer, his DNA is not in any kind of felon database, state or federal database, so they've had a problem with that. So what they're hoping is that maybe he might have a relative that's in the prison system. And some experts say that if you're a felon, there's a good chance that you might have a brother, a cousin, or a father who is a felon. So there's a chance that
wow.
he might have a relative who's in the database. Because he's not in it, there's a chance that he might have a relative who is, and they might be able to find him through that.
Well, the mystery continues, and the story is the one broken by journalist Christine Pelisek. She broke it for the LA Weekly. And as we said, the investigation continues. Headlines continue from Femi Okeh now.
Thank you, John. Just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Investment giant Lehman Brothers announced nearly $4 billion in quarterly losses this morning. The company's lost billions in the subprime crisis, and further losses sent stocks plummeting yesterday. The CEO announced major changes in a conference call this morning. Scientists cheered as a beam of protons completed a circuit of the Large Hadron Collider today. The particle smasher was switched on for the first time this morning. The 17-mile ring is buried far beneath the Alps, and physicists hope that the massive machine will help solve mysteries about dark matter and the origin of the universe. OPEC oil ministers surprised everybody with their announcement yesterday that they're slashing output by almost 500,000 barrels a day. Analysts were predicting production would stay the same. The news sent oil prices back up slightly in Asian trading. They dropped steeply from record-breaking highs in July. Hurricane Ike is hanging out over the Gulf of Mexico this morning and is aiming for Texas. Gulf Coast residents are bracing for a hit sometime Saturday morning, and forecasts say the storm could get stronger as it moves over the ocean. Ike could be a Category 3 by the time it hits near Corpus Christi this weekend. And that's a look at your news, international and domestic, for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, probing topical issues such as mothers who meet at a bar for drinks and bring their babies. Is it fair to the other patrons? Is it fair for bars to prohibit them? Conversations found at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. They're trading on Wall Street. The market is up, both the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones Industrial Average. We've been talking about the Lehman Brothers story. More about that in a moment. Today, we're talking about super colliders and bipolar disorder in children and families' stories of how they're dealing with it.
Hi, team. This is Mark in Westfield, New Jersey. My son is afflicted with bipolar, opposition and defiant disorder, ADHD, and a bunch of other things. Alphabet soup, we call it. The hardest thing we find is the fact that once we have the diagnosis, working with the rest of the community in order to get support services for him. It's a very difficult, very frustrating task to be his parent. And the most important thing we've figured out is how to get support groups so that we can feel normal.
Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. That conversation came from an article in this Sunday's New York Times. We talked to the author earlier in the show. The Olympics are over, but the Paralympics are in full swing in Beijing, and I'm too old to have a chance at the Paralympics, but other disabled people are definitely there and competing. Scott Rogers is one of them. He's the team captain of the U.S. Paralympic fencing team. That's wheelchair fencing. This is his third Paralympics. Scott picked up a bronze in 04. He's hoping to top that in epee and foil this year. Scott, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
You know, I'm in a quickie titanium wheelchair right now. What are you rolling around in?
Actually, I'm not rolling around. I sort of hobble around.
You're hobbling around.
I'm hobbling around.
Yeah, so you're just lording it over on me there. Thanks a lot, Scott. What's it like to do wheelchair fencing? How is your chair different when you actually do Paralympic fencing?
The chair has it's probably a little taller than the chair you're rolling around in, and it's we have a side piece on the left side. For me, at least, I'm right-handed. The lefties have one on the other side, and there's also a handle to hold on to so that when we lunge across at our opponents, we don't fall out and hit the floor.
And the chair is actually fixed to the floor during the actual competition, right?
That's correct. It's fixed to a frame, which both participants are in, and keeps the distance fixed between us and keeps us from falling out on the floor.
Now, depending on the event in the Paralympics, often the excitement about the Paralympics is that there is an athletic dimension of the disability in the event that increases the sense of excitement and athleticism that often makes a disability sport or a Paralympic sport more exciting to watch than a traditional athletic sport. How does that manifest itself in fencing?
Well, in fencing, in the able-bodied world, they're able to run up and down the strip, and they can separate and keep or make the distance wider. In wheelchair fencing, we can't change the distance. The distance is fixed at the beginning of the bout, and so the only way for us to change the distance is by leaning our body, and we must keep our rear ends in the seat at all times. And so it ends up being more exciting because there's a lot more blade work and a lot more action in very close quarters.
A lot more blade work. I love that. So it's actually like a fencing match where the two fighters are in each other's face the whole time.
Pretty much. We're perfect distance the whole time. So it makes it, you have to be defensive all the time. There's no time to sit back and rest.
All right. So who are favored? I mentioned your bronze in 04, but who are favored? Who are the tough teams in wheelchair fencing?
The Chinese team is tough. The Hong Kong team will be tough. The French team is tough. Hopefully we're going to be tough. And the Polish team is tough. There's a lot of tough guys out there.
Well, of course the French team is tough. I mean, they invented this, right?
This is their sport.
So they say.
Yeah. Yes. Now, you know, if I roll down the street here in New York with a sword in my lap, you know, I'll get a lot of attention. Do you ever wander around with your fencing apparatus when you're at home?
Not too much. Most of the time when I'm wandering around the streets of San Diego, I have it tucked away in my bag.
And what advantage do you have? What do you think you do as a fencer that gives you an advantage?
For me, I think it's a chess game. I think there's some guys, there are a lot of guys that are stronger than I am, a lot of guys that are faster than I am. I like to think I'm able to be more tactical and smarter than my opponents.
Do you have a preference, epee and foil?
Typically, I'm mostly a foilist. I train in foil most of the time, and then I fence epee as a secondary weapon. Although I fence epee, my epee results have been slightly better than my foil results. So.
You know, there's been a lot of talk among people with disabilities who are athletes that the support for the training for the Paralympics is minuscule compared to that for the traditional Olympics. And while it might be expected that there would be some disparity, there's really no excuse for the lack of support for disabled athletes. What's your view of that?
Well, it's a tough one to go. I know I talk to our able-bodied fencing athletes, and they get some support, but fencing's not a sport that gets a lot of support either way. for the most part, what I've seen is that once you perform, you get a little bit of support, but you're pretty much supporting yourself. Unfortunately, we're not track and field or basketball or sort of a headlining sport in the U.S., so we tend to get a little less support.
So what's the most exciting event that you've seen in any of the Paralympic sports so far? I know you're focused mostly on the fencing, but I imagine you've been able to see some of the other events take place.
We have. We went to watch the swimming yesterday, and I saw a guy with no arms swim the backstroke, which it's quite amazing.
Yeah, I don't think I can even imagine that.
I know. We watched a guy come out with no arms and go down the pool, and it was just wild.
Is there a no-arm category for backstroke, or is he just competing along with everybody else?
He's just competing along with everybody else. In his category, there were some guys with arms and some guys with no arms and some guys with no legs. It was crazy.
Well, guys with arms, no arms, legs, no legs, women, men. It's the Paralympics. Yep. Scott Rogers, thanks for joining us.
Mm-hmm. My pleasure.
Scott Rogers is the team captain of the U.S. Paralympic fencing team in Beijing. No arm backstroke. That's pretty amazing. Femi Okay is here with the headlines.
Hello there to you, John. Just looking at the medal tables for the Paralympic Games. China is ahead with 13 golds. Great Britain behind them with 9. And the USA has 4 gold medals so far. But we still have another week of competition to go.
Good luck to Scott.
Yes. Cuba and Florida are still getting winds and rain from Hurricane Ike. A tornado may have touched down in the upper Florida Keys this morning. Forecasters say that Ike could strengthen into a major hurricane again as it travels through the Gulf of Mexico toward Texas. Lehman Brothers says that it will sell a majority stake in its prized investment management business and spin off of its commercial real estate operations as it tries to survive the credit crunch. Lehman reports a loss of nearly $4 billion in the third quarter. Kim Jong-il is not sick, and that's according to North Korean officials. Reports from the U.S. and South Korean intelligence say, though, that the North Korean leader may have suffered a stroke last night. Even seen some reports of him having had an operation. Kim missed yesterday's celebrations of North Korea's 60th year anniversary. And he's one of Haiti's most famous sons, music producer and rapper Wyclef Jean. Wyclef is setting up the Haiti Storm Relief Fund. It will send food, tents and supplies to Haiti. The website is bang up to date with pictures of flooding from Gustav and also Ike. And you can help out by dialing into yelly.org. More on Haiti and the Caribbean and the storms coming up later in the program.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. At the opening bell on Wall Street, the embattled investment bank Lehman Brothers was up. Its stock was up about 15%. It's the first reaction since the fiasco yesterday, where Lehman Brothers appeared to lose almost half of its stock value and announced this morning on a conference call about 2 hours ago its third quarter results. Reporter for The New York Times, Ben Weick, was on that conference call. Ben, what was Lehman Brothers' reaction, and how do you think they did in reassuring the market this morning?
Well, you mentioned that 15% jump at the open. I think it's given most of that up, and it's now like 2%. So I think there's a mixed reaction, and the big question is, you know, is this enough? There wasn't a whole lot new here. We knew they were going to attempt to spin off a lot of their troubled commercial real estate assets into a new company. They're going to do that. We knew they were going to try to sell some of their investment management division. They're going to do that. And they had a big loss, $3.9 billion, and huge write-downs on all of these bad real estate holdings. $5.6 billion. The question is, you know, is this going to be enough to restore confidence? Is it going to be enough to allow Lehman to have enough capital moving forward? And I think, obviously, we'll see that play out in the market as the day goes forward. I think the answer right now is we don't know.
We don't know, right. CEO Dick Fuld was on the call this morning, and your colleague Floyd Norris described his use of the word de-risking as a bit of linguistic torture, I guess he said. Fuld also seemed to try to encourage investors to think that these talks on selling assets are actually real. He said, you know, the results will be known very, very soon, right. But there's really no specifics in there.
Yeah, that's the problem. I mean, you know, investors have been waiting for a long time. It's a couple of quarters where Lehman has said, you know, these are our plans. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. I think people really want to see these deals happen, and particularly the investment management division sale. And they do say they're very close. They want, you know, final bids by this weekend, and that they could get, you know, as much as $5 billion for that while somehow retaining a majority of the net income from the business. All of us are trying to figure out exactly how they'll both sell a majority stake and retain the majority of the earnings. So that's a bit of a trick.
Ben, is there a numerical point in the stock price at Lehman Brothers where they're not going to be able to avoid just a wholesale takeover?
I'm sure there is. You know, they're what, at $8 now. If they got, you know, significantly down below that, I think you would see people start to show some interest. You know, and obviously Dick was asked that question on the call. At what point do you just ultimately sell out to a bigger player who can, you know, help recapitalize your balance sheet? But you don't see a whole lot of banks scrambling to pick up, you know, an alien investment bank that's saddled with all these huge real estate assets. So the question is, sure, they'd be vulnerable to a takeover, but who wants to buy them?
And at this price, I mean, you know, if Bear Stearns is any indication, you want to go for 1 cent on the dollar, not, you know, $4 a share.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So what's what does this mean for the rest of the market? Certainly, this is just one story and we just have a few seconds. But any other trends moving on the market this morning?
You know, I think this will probably be viewed, you know, mildly positively, that they're trying to take steps to move in the right direction. They're not announcing they're filing for bankruptcy. They're not announcing some emergency Fed bailout. So it could take a little bit of the nerves out that we saw yesterday. So I'd say it's probably a moderate positive, but I wouldn't imagine it to give the market a big bounce.
And so Wall Street will just move on to the next crazy story. Ben White, thanks for being with us.
You got it. Thanks.
Ben White, New York Times reporter, covering the opening on Wall Street as investors hash over the announcement of Lehman Brothers' third quarter results, a $3.9 billion loss.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, and we begin with headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The big financial story this morning is about Lehman Brothers. They released some dismal numbers, almost $4 billion in losses for the third quarter. CEO Dick Fuld also announced a large-scale reorganization to reduce future risk for shareholders.
These will accomplish a substantial de-risking of our balance sheet and reinforce the emphasis on our client-focused businesses.
I did look up de-risking, and it said I don't think so, but there is a website called derisk.com if you want to check that one out. But I have a feeling it's got nothing to do with what's happening over at Lehman Brothers. So we move on with other financial stories. Oil prices have risen above $100 a barrel after last night's decision by OPEC to cut its global output by just over 500,000 barrels a day. The decision was taken at an OPEC meeting called to discuss the recent sharp fall in oil prices after they'd risen to a peak of nearly $150 a barrel. And it's the world's biggest physics experiment, and for now, it's a success. Scientists have fired a beam of protons all the way around a 70-mile tunnel beneath the Swiss-French border. The $3.8 billion Large Hadron Collider is science's best hope of understanding the makeup of the universe, and 9,000 physicists from around the world will conduct experiments on the collider.
John. Thank you, Femi. Well, they know the machine works, but the experiment, I guess, begins in a couple of weeks.
That's true.
The footprints of Hurricane Ike are deep and wide across the Caribbean already, even as the U.S. prepares for a strike. Cuba took a second hit from Ike this week, and it's carried into the Gulf of Mexico, where it's going to gain strength before it hits the U.S. Michael Voss is in Havana for our partners, the BBC. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, John.
And also involved in the relief effort in Haiti for churches and for Haitians living here in the United States. Joining us from Miami is Pastor Reginald Jean-Marie of Notre Dame de Haiti Catholic Church from the Little Haiti neighborhood of Miami. Pastor, thanks for being with us.
Well, it's a pleasure, and I greet everybody who are listening to the show today, and thank you for having us.
Well, first of all, Pastor, you know, Haiti has really been hard hit. Can you explain the scale of the problems in Haiti and how difficult it is to deliver aid from your parishioners there from Miami?
Yes, actually, the situation is very chaotic in Haiti. I was in Haiti 3 days before before the storm Ike, and things were already very difficult because there was no food, no water to drink, and a lot of people lost the plantations, the livestock. So, and after the passing of Ike, I can imagine things are getting worse, and now it is very, very difficult to deliver food to the people due to the fact that all the bridges are cut down, and also still there is no way of transportation and communication via the road. So now it's still very difficult, and we don't know exactly when the government is going to be able to pave ways for the people to get the food.
Well, the United Nations suggests that $3 to $4 billion of damage has been imposed on Cuba from the double hit of Gustav and Ike. Michael Voss, Cuba usually prides itself on its preparedness for storms, but I suspect this has been a bit of a tough go for the Cuban people.
Yes, it has. I mean, it's one of the things about Ike is that it been moving incredibly slowly. So it spent almost 2 days sitting over Cuba, moving from the Cayman at the east, went all the way up to the west, bringing not just the heavy the winds, but incredibly heavy rains as well. And that's been a big problem. And the week before had been Hurricane Gustav, which came in as an absolutely devastating Category 4 and damaged 100,000 homes. So, yes, the communist authorities in Cuba take hurricane preparedness very seriously. Lots and lots of people were moved to safety, but still the destructive power of two big hurricanes in a week was terrible. Apparently, 2.6 million people, which is almost a quarter of the island's population, were moved to safer places and shelters in the last week.
And the fact that the storm Ike hit both sides of the island in different sort of hits meant that some people had to move twice.
Yes, they did. The second, what happened was it came in at the east, it went across the eastern end of the island and then followed the coast of Cuba, the eye of the hurricane just offshore, and then took a right and went up through the west. But even when it was following the coastal region with the eye offshore, the rest inland, because it was so close to the shore, was still getting the hurricane force winds and the rain. The worst hit area is actually in the west, in Pinar del Rio, which is the premium tobacco-growing country for Cuba's famous cigars. And it was Pinar del Rio which last week took a direct hit from Gustav. They lost electricity, hundreds of thousands of homes damaged. And then yesterday, that's exactly where Ike went before it left the country. They've had two hits. I know of one family who had most of their house destroyed, but had one room, the kitchen, was still intact. They lost that yesterday.
Pastor Reginald Jean-Marie, in Miami, the Archdiocese has put out a call for donations. What has the response been for the people of Haiti?
It has been very positive, especially yesterday. We saw a lot of people coming to bring things to be able to help the victims, and we saw that the media responded very well as well to the crisis. So far, we can say that things are going very well, and we're hoping that in the next days that people will continue coming to help us. And also, we have a lot of institutions like medical institutions, the school. We got even flight attendants on different airlines who are trying to collect things, collect goods, and also to make monetary donations to Haiti. So we just pray and hope that the momentum will be on for the next few days.
You mentioned that most, if not all, of the bridges are out in Haiti from the storms. There are also other unique infrastructure problems in Haiti. Can you describe them quickly?
Well, there is no doubt Haiti has a great level of problems in terms of infrastructures. It's not just about the bridges that are broken. It's the fact also that the local authorities and the government has no control over people, most especially as to where they can build. If you look at the situation in Cabaret, it seems that a lot of people build the houses near the rivers. And that's what happens very often, especially when we have storms in Haiti. So when the storms come, you know, they just take the houses, and the houses are not even solid. And also, we find out that there is no drainage in Haiti where the water can flow. So, and also, it's a lack of education also in terms of the storms, especially for a country like Haiti that every year that will be hit by hurricanes. So there should be a bureau in Haiti that can at least educating people about the danger, about the threat of the storms, and there should be a plan also by the government and the local authorities to evacuate people. Just we saw things happen in Cuba. You know, things have been catastrophic.
Well, speaking of Cuba, Michael Voss, by the time Hurricane Ike hits the Texas or Louisiana coast, do you think you'll have the power on in your office?
Well, we're hoping so, but it's virtually the whole of Havana is without electricity. I'm in an office building that's got its own generator, which is why I'm able to talk to you now. But it's one of the last things that Ike did before it went out into the Gulf of Mexico was sort of damage the national grid, and it isn't just Havana that's suffering. Virtually the whole of the country is having serious problems getting electricity at the moment.
The rebuilding begins. The BBC's Michael Voss reports from Havana for the BBC. Thanks so much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
And dealing with donations from the people of Miami for the people of Haiti, Pastor Reginald Jean-Marie of Notre Dame de Haiti Catholic Church. Thank you for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Blessings to you and to everyone.
And that's not the last of Ike. More on that. Your ways to catch up with us at The Takeaway, you can find us on Twitter, Friend Feed, and Facebook. Right, Femi?
Absolutely. And today we've been talking about OPEC trimming production by more than 500,000 barrels a day. We're also tracking the Paralympics in Beijing and super colliders underground. Is this how the world might end? What's the last thing you would do if it does? Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
All right, check out this. Is one of our listeners. Arlen points out, as crazy as this black hole destroys the Earth idea is, not the universe, by the way, we wouldn't be out of the woods yet. If the collider does make black holes, it will be when they turn both beams on, colliding in opposite directions. Femi, are you taking notes?
I am.
If they do make black holes, however, quantum mechanical effects will make the black holes evaporate instantaneously, and they won't destroy the Earth or the universe. Feel better?
Goodness me. Mr. Clevington Mark II, here's your takeaway.
Well, Alaskans always knew we were the center of the universe, and now everyone else is realizing it, too.
Yes, but what about the quantum mechanics? That was Libby Casey, the Washington correspondent for Alaska Public Radio Network, talking about the trial of Alaskan Senator Ted Stevens. Gotta go. Femi, what do you say?
I'm Femi Okay.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.